And then you moved to Seattle. You get a job at...
I lived in Philly for 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
After that, you moved to Seattle. Yep. To work at a bookstore.
Yeah, Borders.
Borders Books.
That's do you remember them?
I remember them. Yes, I do.
So, yeah, they're in Philly. I've been working in the Borders in the airport. That was the one time I ever got fired, was showing up 2 hours late to that Borders, because I had been drunk with some poets the night before, and, you know, I had stupidly agreed to open the bookstore in the airport. And if you don't open on time at an airport, I don't know if you know this, but you get fined significantly. Your business gets fined like $2,000. And that's like the month's intake, right? That's a lot of money for a tiny bookstore. Because, you know, your poet employee who's the opener didn't open the gates. Because that experience obviously looks terrible in an airport context. Can't have businesses that aren't open. But anyway, they rehired me, and then when I moved to Seattle...
Despite that, they rehired you.
Yeah, you know, the guy, Greg Moore was... Hopefully he comes across this. Greg Moore was the store manager at the time. He had come from, you know, McDonald's, like being a regional manager, and he moved to books because he thought that books would be a new challenge, and blah, blah, blah. He ends up, you know, really enjoying me, and I think he kind of like looked at me as a son in a way. And he loved coaching me, but he was like... This was a lesson, you know, but then he rehired me and he's just like, well, he's not going to open the store anymore, which was good for me because I really hated that. But anyway,
send you to Seattle.
Seattle, end up getting hired at the airport here, the airport store, before it closed. And that was 6 years ago. So that was still when Seattle was slightly affordable. I was, you know, living here in Columbia City, and the two people I moved here with and I first shared an apartment that cost it was a two bedroom for like $1,000 with a huge nice view over the library. No, it was not. This was not the Angeline. And then we moved into a house, and we were able to get a three bedroom house with a full basement and 2 yards. I think you were at that house actually, and that was only like $1,500. It's awesome. And so we were all able to just, you know, work part-time jobs. The three of us, my roommates and I, all worked at Borders. And then Jared Middleton, who used to live here in this neighborhood, he ended up inviting me to work at a marketing company, a tech marketing company in downtown Seattle. And that's kind of, that's where the ball rolled.
And then you've decided to channel all this tree pyromania, anarcho-leftist leanings into being a librarian.
Yeah.
You know, some people would think that would be a funny or ironic statement, but I say that with complete sincerity, that librarians are kind of undercover badasses when it comes to maintaining real culture and standing up for values that are very, I would call them American values, but I'm not sure I even believe that exists. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So why a librarian? Is it because of this impulse, or because it was a good way to make a living, or what?
Well, why originally and why now, I think, are two different things. And I think the why now kind of relates back to what you were just saying, which we'll talk about in a second. But why then? It basically moved from, in Philly, I'd been an educator. I'd been working within an AmeriCorps program called City or Greater Philadelphia. And I worked in the schools, and I, you know, actually literally my office was in a burned out bathroom in the basement of Olney High School West, right next to the library, which was also in the basement.
How far is this from the MOVE building that was bombed by the authorities?
This was like a significantly far
location
from that.
Because when I think of Philadelphia, I think of that, and I think of Momia, and I think of the real, you know, racist police force.
No, so that school was in the northernmost part of the city, which has a very comparable vibe to the area where the MOVE building is in West Philly. They're both very ghettoized areas. Racist authoritarianism from police is very present. You know, you have the police lights on street poles that flash to let people that are driving through know they're in a high crime area. Can you imagine living under one of those? You have, you know, bombed out buildings that just have never been repaired, that have, you know, all manner of heroin addicts or crack addicts or otherwise impoverished people living in them. You have, you know, trash, piles of trash everywhere. This is like the built environment, the human environment and human presence in those neighborhoods.
And you're mentoring someone in a neighborhood like this.
Yeah, that's the kind of space that that organization would go and visit and embed itself in. A lot of the folks that were part of the teams that would be assigned to these schools were from not necessarily that specific neighborhood, but that region of the city. And so they had, you would have that anchor. As an outsider, of course, that's what I was. I had to have an anchor. And if the anchors didn't exist, if those locals didn't exist to provide some context, in other words, if I had just been thrown into that space, I would have probably been terrified, afraid, hopeless, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those feelings, of course, came up. But there was a camaraderie that existed there. To relate it back to your question about libraries and librarianship, though, that kind of fueled what I found in libraries throughout my life, that feeling, that same kind of camaraderie, that stability and structure. And I think that when we think of the benefit and value of libraries, even in an age where you have literally words spoken from friends of mine in the tech industry who say, why are there still libraries? Why do they exist? Or I can't believe they still exist. You know, they're off in their own little bubbles and they have that perspective. That's the best answer, is that they provide structure and stability, especially in an age and a region that is so concentrated in immediacy and these rapid developments and these rapid releases of products and platforms and new technologies. The library becomes even more powerful and more reliable as a space that anyone can go to. And that anyone component is really kind of where I've found the value now that I am in that profession. That is, I can be undercover and my purpose as a librarian will always be founded upon this equitable opportunity that it is an experience that has existed for a long time, not only in this country, but in other countries, and it still exists in other forms in other countries, but it's also rooted in that protection, that elitism, that special almost class, not necessarily economic class, but that social class of intellectuals and conservationists that are able to acknowledge that they are providing a good space and good service to other people around them. Fortunately, it's not, you know, the ancient librarianship that exists now. I think that a lot of different types of people can become librarians, and a lot of people, different types of people, not only the wealthiest and not only the whitest people, can make the decisions of the libraries and the associations and the organizations that allow them to exist and support them and promote them. All sorts of people are in positions of power in libraries, and we keep seeing libraries as being those organizations that represent values that a lot of people are not even aware of. Think about net neutrality, think about privacy, think about intellectual freedom, the ability to go, you know, onto a computer and search for whatever you want, how to make a bomb, how to watch porn, how to impeach a president, how to grow a pea patch, how to, you know, look up silly poems by Charles Bernstein, how to do whatever. That ability is supported by this space that is neutral and very empathetic.
And is part of the commons.
Yeah.
And exists with a sort of inherent egalitarianism that, by and large,
exactly,
does not exist in capitalist culture.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's part of what attracts you to the whole career as a librarian.
Right. And that was what made the switch. You know, I was making significantly more in working for a business corporation downtown. And I could have just kept doing that. And I could have been 4 years further in that trajectory. But there was a certain degree of mindfulness, or maybe I wouldn't call it mindfulness. There was just a certain awakening that happened sitting in one of those cubicles and realizing that, yeah, maybe this technology I was working on and promoting would help some people, particularly people that were in the business, the sector that I was, you know, working in, contributing my energy, my intellect to that might help some people, but does it help everyone? Does everyone benefit from this? No. And in the end, the people that benefit the most are the people on top.
Why do you want to help people?
That's a big question. I think mostly it stems from wanting to help myself or seeing where I've needed help in my past. It's a selfish and or self-centered route that exists. When I was young, I found the libraries in my life to be places I could go to feel warmth, to feel people, the librarians, or even just the space, or even just the people that were in this common agreement that they were there for a reason, in the library for a reason. That was a very attractive feeling for me. Growing up in a working class and then middle class childhood home that was fractured without a father, with a mother that was working in an incredible amount, and then with a very caustic stepfather, those influences in the home life were very, very, very disruptive. And in a lot of ways, those other resources, like the library for me, ended up becoming really, really supportive and really, really inspiring. That extends itself to today. I think it's a fairly easy logic to follow. But also, I mean, if we bring it back to Seattle, there just seems to be so much inequity and so much oppression here, like everywhere, but I'm just aware of it more now here that I live here, now that I live here. And you're going to say,
well, Seattle's the most liberal city in the country, one of the top three or four. How can you say that?
Well, yeah, but who lives here? Have you seen that Saturday Night Live sketch on Brooklyn? I think it's called The Bubble.
The Bubble, I haven't seen that, yes.
I mean, that's how it feels. And, of course, you have locals that haven't sold their houses yet, and they can still afford to pay the taxes on them. And, they're, you know, it's only a matter of time. But look at all of the people.
It's over. You say it's over.
I think so, yeah. I don't really see how, for the majority of the population here, all can be welcome. And how does that stem on a sociological level? How does that work with the groups of people that are operating here and how people have community identity? I should say that, you know, there are elements and faces to this authentic, caring kind of nature. Because I've been in the greater Columbia City neighborhood for a while, I see where a lot of that support and that neighborliness exists. And that, I think, is really important. But I also see, almost in a Borgian fashion, all of the virus-like, you know, productions of these large, dense buildings. And I think that warmth and that inclusivity and that egalitarian kind of premise is definitely threatened. And I think that a lot of the populations that could have been kicked out really easily have been kicked out. And there hasn't been, and I'm not an expert on this, so I don't know why, but there hasn't been a huge fight or not a huge fight, there hasn't been a huge success in keeping people present.
Yeah.